Welcome to GeoTalk, the podcast for geocaches down under. In this third episode of GeoTalk, we speak to nobodies from WA on caching without a GPS receiver, continue my tour of the best caches in the Australian Capital Territory, and learn all about how to avoid snakes in the bush. Or listen more on GeoTalk. Welcome to the third episode of GeoTalk, the podcast for geocaches down under. I'm your host, Darren Osborne. Well, Christmas is only 3 weeks away, and by now most of you should have dropped enough hints to suggest to the family what you want, and I'm sure many of you have got something to do with geocaching in that list. And hopefully many of you in the past week or two have been able to join one of the many geocaching events that have been held around the country, as they do before Christmas. I was lucky enough to join the one over in Sydney and met a lot of new faces that I haven't seen before, and also connecting faces to some names that I've been reading about for the past 3 or 4 years. So that was a lot of fun. Thanks to Team WebGuy for putting that together in the Sydney region, and I'm sure everyone will put their hands together for everyone who coordinated those events around the country. In the next episode, you're going to hear from a few of the geocaches that I met at the Sydney event, so look out for that one. That's coming up in episode 4. Some of you may have noticed that on the geocaching.com website, there's a worldwide travel bug promotion. Now, if you haven't visited the site, do it quickly, because they're giving away 20,000 travel bugs free of charge. You don't even have to pay for the postage, even if you're in Australia. And it's part of raising awareness for diabetes. So check that out at unite.geocaching.com or visit the GeoTalk website. I'll put a link on the front page there. Don't forget, if you've got anything that you want to say, or any milestones, cheerios, or ideas for shows, you can either drop it in an email or even attach it to an email and send it to geotalk@mac.com. Well, let's jump into the next segment of the show. Papa Bear Left from Perth, you may have remembered, interviewed Clyde in the last two episodes. Well, he speaks to a geocacher who's synonymous for finding geocaches without a GPS receiver.
Talking today to Nobodies, alias Zed. It started a while ago and is now, but only now, the proud owner of a new GPS. But the last, well, how many, you've done 62 caches now. How many of those did you do without a GPS?
I'd love to say 50, but it's around about 40.
Right. How do you do it? I mean, what's the procedure?
Well, the first one I found, once reading the clues, I then had to find out where the actual cache was. And it was at about that same time that I discovered Multimap.
Useful tool.
And discovered how, when you actually clicked on it, up in the address field, actually gave you the south and east in decimal places. And by modifying that, you could push the little circle around. Or completely overtyping it with the new cache, because obviously the offset was about 800 odd metres away, so just by moving a little bit, it didn't do it. But that was basically how it started. Once I'd solved the, or thought I'd solved the little riddle or the quiz that was on the page, I then converted the minutes into the full decimal, a decimal point, typed it in, and circle moved from there to a new location. Once I got there, I'm thinking to myself, this might be a bit hard, But at the same time, this is where another thing comes into it, I'd seen one of the pictures on the page.
Right.
And it was a picture of a hill.
Right.
It says, the cache is up there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There was one feature that's just stood out. And it was, so we were walking around, and I just walked over this little ridge on a track and come out into a clearing which overlooked this beautiful valley, and I looked to my right, up there on the hill, I thought, that looks familiar. So I just started walking up to it. And as I was walking up, there was just this large boulder sitting slightly to my left, and I thought, Let's go look. So that was totally surprising. Mm-hmm. I just happened to walk up this boulder, looked over the edge underneath this little hollow, and there was this little blue bag looking at me.
You were saying that Google Earth has been quite useful as well.
Yes, now Google Earth is, has... Well, first it was Google Satellite, because obviously I discovered the satellite pictures before I actually installed or released Google Earth. And you can only get down to a certain point. You know, not, you can't zoom down as far as Google Earth, but it gave me a enough indication, like if I'm looking for a track junction or something, or a clearing.
And some natural feature.
Yeah, some natural feature which I knew if I walked along this track far enough, I knew I could see the path and see the stream or the water course.
Yeah, the whole idea of when you get somewhere near the cache, stop following the magic arrow, look up, look around, and think, where would I find a cache here?
Yes. Well, that's the other thing, my search area, like I've seen people complaining about the reading being, you know, 7 metres out.
Yes.
My search area for starters are 25 metres, which means I'm searching a circle 50 metres wide.
Mm. Yes.
Because as much as I think I've pinpointed it, I don't trust.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have something that will sit there and average and then tell me 5 minutes later that, yes, I'm within 10 metres or yes, I'm within 5 metres.
Yes.
And I find that even searching an area that big, even if you're looking, say, under a grass tree, it doesn't have to take that long to look.
So now you've got a GPS now, so hopefully, though, you won't forget the skills you've learned from being a GPS-less.
Yes, but well, now I feel like a real GPS, geocacher. But actually, the skills are probably going to be harder is not to look at the clues, not to look at the pictures, and actually go out there and try and find the cache. If anybody has ever followed what I've been doing, is you'll find that most of my caches are 2.2s or above, because I just wanted the challenge of finding the harder ones.
Well, good luck with your second geocaching career as a with this artificial aid.
Yes.
And I hope you're as successful with the GPS as you have been without it.
Welcome back to the second part of my special on geocaching in Canberra. Although many of the urban caches in the Canberra region provide spectacular views, it's the higher peaks and the valleys outside of the city that offer the greatest rewards. Tourist Drive 5 is a loop road that takes you through the Tibimbilla Valley, and along this road you'll find a few simple caches such as Cotter Comeback, Mineshaft and Long Distance Call. The latter is located close to the NASA-operated Canberra Deep Space Communication Complex, which is well worth a visit. Some slightly more difficult ones close to this road include A Loaf of Sugar, Hardy Ha Ha, and Canberra's Horizon. Canberra's legendary geocacher Tank Engine has set up a number of excellent caches along the Murrumbidgee River, naturally called Murrumbidgee Meander 1, 2, and 3, and I recommend that you give all of them a try. If you venture further south, you'll enter Namadgi National Park, which takes about two-thirds of the ACT and includes some of the hardest geocaches the nation's capital has to offer. A good starting point is the geographic centre of the territory, Honeysuckle Creek. This former space tracking station was the place where the first television signals from the Apollo 11 moonwalk were received in July 1969. It's now a camping ground and a great place to base yourself as you tackle Legoland and South Canberra views, which was actually melted during the bushfires of 2003, but somehow survived. At night, if you're game, you can also try the dark side, which combines a long climb and searching by torchlight. Further south are the relatively easy Gudgeonby Gander and the Namadgi Yank, but if you're more adventurous, try Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Clear Loop, Southern Outpost, and the mountain bike-inspired Smoking. In this region, you'll also find the end waypoint for Checkmate. If you're looking for a high view of the surrounding region, then you can't go past the two biggest peaks in the ACT, which host A Long Way to the Top and the Top ACT. You should be fully prepared for all weather conditions if you intend to find these geocaches, as they're both in alpine regions, which can be extremely cold and unpredictable even during the summer months. Let me finish up with two of what I think are probably the most sadistic caches in the ACT. The first is Going Commando, which not only required me stripping down to my underwear to cross a river, but also a bit of rock skiing on the way back down a steep incline. The second cache, which is actually not in the ACT but just outside, also deserves a mention. Vertigo is a difficult cache to get to if you have a four-wheel drive, and even more difficult if you do it by motorbike or, like myself, on foot. There was no way I was going to not find that geocache after spending 2.5 hours walking to it and then knowing that it was going to take me longer to get back. Don't say I didn't warn you on those two. Well, that's my tour through what I regard as some of the best caches in the Canberra region. Fortunately, there are more geocaches joining the sport in the ACT, and hopefully we'll see a lot more excellent caches that make the ACT one of the best places to go geocaching in the country. Summer in Australia usually means hot weather, bushfires and snakes. Despite having 7 of the 10 most venomous snakes in the world, few Australians actually die from snake bite. Last week I ventured to Taronga Zoo in Sydney to learn about Australia's snakes and what to do if you encounter one. Okay, I'm here at Taronga Park Zoo with Stuart Kozlowski, who is a zookeeper in the reptile section, and we're going to cover a bit about snakes. Stuart, first of all, how do you know if you're in an area where there might be snakes?
Well, in Australia, pretty much all areas have snakes. We have 172 different species of snakes all throughout this country. To get a bit more specific, anywhere where there is good untouched bush, you will find many, many different species of snakes. Many species of snakes in Australia are water lovers. You're walking on the sides of creeks, riverbanks, things like that. And also many snakes are arboreal here in this country as well. So you've also just got to not watch out on the ground, but also watch out high up in trees as well where these species might be found.
Now, we're not necessarily just going to find these out in the bush. You can find them in urban regions, can't you?
Definitely. We have many species that are found all throughout suburbia. In Sydney alone, we have 3 of the top 5 most venomous land snakes in the world, which could be even found in people's backyards. Things like the common brown snake, the red-bellied black snake, and also the common death adder are all found in urban Sydney.
Now, before we put the fear of snakes into everyone, I mean, what are the chances that if you're walking around, say, in a park or in a national park, that you're likely to encounter a snake?
The chances of encountering a snake are pretty slim. The chances of actually even getting bitten by a snake are even slimmer. The things you have to remember are, as long as you leave these animals alone, more times out of not, they're going to leave you alone. The majority of people that do get bitten by snakes in Australia are people that are trying to catch or kill a snake.
So if you're going out for a bushwalk, what are the precautions that you should take before you actually get out of the car and go walking?
The best precaution is to actually wear long pants and a good pair of boots. Majority of our Australian snakes have very, very small fangs. You have a good pair of trousers on, thick socks, a good pair of hiking boots, which you probably would have. You've already given yourself a 99% protection against those snakes.
Okay, now let's say we're walking along a trail and a snake is lying in front of the trail. What should we do?
The best thing to do is to stay completely still. Snakes have terrible eyesight. Their best sense is their sense of taste or smell with their tongue. If you remain completely still, to a snake, you're an inanimate object. You're a tree or a log or a rock. If you start jumping up and down or moving aggressively towards a snake or even actually just stepping over him, he sees that as a threat. You're an animal that's trying to hurt him, and he's going to react in the only way that snakes do, and that is to either flee or to protect themselves by biting.
Okay, so now let's say we've gotten into the unfortunate circumstance where we have been bitten by a snake or one of our friends have. What's the best thing to do?
Okay, the first thing you have to do is remain calm. Stay very, very calm. If you are the victim, just sit down, stay nice and calm, control your breathing, try not to elevate your heart rate, and then you have to use a compression bandage. The best first aid for any snake bite in Australia is a compression bandage, where you will wrap with a bandage. If you don't have a bandage, you can use a torn up piece of clothing or car upholstery, any type of material that you have available. Wrap from all the way at the bottom of the limb. The majority of bites happen on the legs when you're bushwalking, so you would wrap from the toes all the way up, as far up the limb as possible. Keep that limb very, very still and try and keep it below your heart. Don't elevate the limb, keep it below your heart. The reason for this is that Australian snake venom travels through the lymphatic system, which is just underneath the skin. So by compressing the skin, we're slowing that movement of venom down. You don't have to stop the blood from circulating. You don't want to put the bandage on so tight that you get pins and needles, but as tight as you would for a sprained ankle or a sprained wrist is fine. And then once you are all bandaged up and nice and calm, get a friend to try and get you to help.
Okay. Now, sometimes some people go bushwalking by themselves. I mean, what should you do if you are in the situation where you've been bitten, you've applied the bandage? Can you actually walk?
You can walk. The main thing is to try and stay calm. So if you do have to walk, if it's, you know, the best case scenario is that you'd have someone there with you. If you don't, then just try and stay nice and calm and walk as slowly and as calmly as you can. Just keep your heart rate nice and low, and that's the best thing that you can do.
Do you know on average how many people get bitten by snakes in Australia?
Yeah, we have around 2,500 people bitten every single year, and on average we lose 2 to 2.5 people each year from those bites.
And then what's the most, common bite that, or most common species that bites?
The most common species is the eastern brown snake. That is a snake which is very prolific throughout the entire eastern half of this entire country. So if you are going to come across a snake, there is a good chance it would be that species, the common brown snake.
Okay, so what snake are we looking at here?
This is a red-bellied black snake, and this is a snake which is found predominantly southeastern Australia. You'll find them down in Victoria, New South Wales. You will find a small population of them in Queensland, but they're more common in New South Wales and Victoria. Now, they're ranked probably in around the 30th most venomous land snake in the world. To date, we have not had a recorded fatality from a red-bellied black snake bite. We get many people bitten every single year, but no recorded fatalities.
And they are regarded as a fairly docile snake, aren't they?
They are regarded as a docile snake. I mean, to me, you want to treat every snake with respect, but these guys are much more likely to actually turn and flee or to slither away than stand up and try and defend themselves or defend their territory. They are actually a snake which is all about intimidation. They will inflate or flatten out their body to make their surface area look bigger, make themselves look more intimidating. They'll let out big hisses to try and scare away a potential predator. But really, when it comes down to it, they're an animal that just wants to flee and get out of your way.
We're looking at a fairly small-looking snake now. This doesn't look too intimidating. It almost looks a little bit like a lizard. What sort of snake are we looking at here?
This is a death adder, and this is another species which you would find around Sydney. You'd also find them pretty much all up and down the east coast, and there's another species found in inland Australia. But this is a species which is not an active snake. They are an ambush predator. A lot of snakes will actually actively chase their food around. This species will sit and wait. They have a tail which is much like a worm, which they will wriggle in front of their mouth to attract their prey, and when that prey grabs onto the tail, the snake will bite them. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people get bitten by them when they accidentally stand on this snake, because it is not a snake that will flee when they feel you coming. They feel the vibrations coming through the ground. They'll actually just sit and hope that they don't get seen by using their camouflage, and inadvertently people do step on them. We have had reports of people also believing that the snake is a blue tongue, because they have this banded patterning, very similar to a blue tongue lizard, and inadvertently picking them up and getting bitten that way.
Now, over here, this is a fairly long-looking snake with a very shiny black head and probably ranks up there in the record books. What sort of snake is it, and why would it be up in the record books?
This is the inland taipan, or the fierce snake, and it does hold the record drop for drop for being the most venomous land snake in the world. In saying that, once again, we have not had a recorded fatality from the inland taipan due to their range or their distribution where they're found. They are found in quite a desert area where you don't get a lot of people visiting. In saying that, people that do visit out there have been several gentlemen bitten when they were many, many hours away from the hospital. They put on the compression bandage, they stayed calm, they made it to a hospital and they survived.
Okay, the two most common snakes, especially in the southeast corner of Australia, would be the brown and the tiger. Can you describe those two and some of the characteristics about them?
Definitely. The brown snake is quite a slender-looking snake. These guys range from, you know, three feet as an adult, 3 feet to maybe 6 or 7 feet long. They're a very slender animal, and when it comes to the colour, just because they're called a brown snake doesn't mean they're brown. We've seen snakes, brown snakes, which are grey, tan, almost all black, a very, very pale cream colour. So the colour is not really distinctive of a brown snake. Something that is very distinctive of a brown snake, if you were to confront one, they will raise their body up in an S shape, and they have very distinct orange spots along their belly. And they'll open their mouth, and they are, for use of a better word, highly defensive, or some people call it aggressive. I prefer highly defensive because you leave the animal alone and he'll leave you alone. But you definitely know when you've come across a brown snake because they tend to want to defend their territory, not just flee out of the way. With the tiger snake, these guys, just because they're called a tiger snake, does not mean that they will have the bands of a tiger. They can be varied in colour to being all one colour with no bands, or having several bands which are ranging in colour from cream to grey to orange or yellow. Now, an interesting point about the tiger snakes is that their main food source are frogs. So you often encounter tiger snakes around rivers, creeks, streams, anywhere where there is a permanent body of water and you can hear frogs calling, or there would be frogs in that area, is a good spot for tiger snakes to actually live. We don't see as many tiger snakes around the Sydney area or the southeastern parts of New South Wales as we used to, because they were killed, they were nearly, you know, almost wiped out many, many years ago. And also with the decline of many frog species in Sydney, once the prey goes, the predator is also going to move off or decline in numbers as well.
Okay, now another type of snake that we find in Australia, you mentioned a little bit earlier, are the pythons. Obviously, they're not venomous, say, like your fear snakes and so forth. What should we know about pythons, and what should we look out for, and why should we avoid them?
The majority of pythons are arboreal species, living high up in trees. And the thing to remember about pythons is, even though they're not venomous, they do have teeth. On average, our Australian pythons have between 90 to maybe 130, 140 needle-sharp teeth. And their teeth are recurved, kind of facing shaped like a fish hook. So once they go into their prey or bite something, those teeth curve in and really latch on quite well. So the thing to remember is that pythons can bite, and pythons are constrictors. That means that they actually kind of subdue their prey by wrapping around it and squeezing it so tight to stop that animal from breathing. Now, the good thing is, in Australia, we don't have any large enough pythons that would look at an adult person as being a food item, but we do have some rather large pythons. The one we're looking at the moment is the scrub python, or the amethystine python, and he's found up in northeastern Queensland. And it is the longest species of python that we have here in Australia, getting up to maybe 20 feet long and weighing in excess of 15 to 20 kilos.
So what do you do if you're unlucky enough to have a python wrapped around you and squeezing you?
Yep. There are two ways that a python will actually bite you. He'll either bite you because he's scared, which is called a defensive bite, which means that he will bite and release and try and get out of your way. Now, they're, for use of a better word, the best bites, because he's just going to bite you, you'll bleed a little bit, not too much to worry about. If that snake believes that you are a food item and gives you what we call a feed bite, where he's going to hold on and really wrap around you, what you have to do is make sure that you can unravel that snake. Snakes just got two ends, the head and the tail. You have to find one of those ends in order to unravel that snake. If there is someone there that can give you a hand, get them to restrain the head while you are unwrapping that snake off you.
What should you do if you're bitten by a python? Would you follow the same procedure as you would if you were bitten by a venomous snake?
No, you don't really have to put a compression bandage on. What you would need to do is stop the bleeding, which might be quite severe if you're bitten by a large python, and then I would also use some sort of antiseptic cream or lotion to rub into that wound, just because snakes can carry bacteria on their teeth. It is very rare to get that infection, but just as a precaution, I would rub it with antiseptic and just stop the bleeding is the main point.
And would you see a doctor afterwards as well?
I would see a doctor just as a precaution. I know many people that get bitten by pythons and no real harm has come to them, but as a precaution, if you are bitten by any snake, I would see a doctor. And the main reason for that is you may not know what species you were bitten by. You may think that you have been bitten by a python when in fact you've been bitten by a mildly or extremely venomous species of snake. So I'd get to a doctor straight away after you've been bitten just to get checked out.
Another thing to look out for, I suppose, when you're out bushwalking are lizards. Now, most lizards are fairly timid and will also run away, but what should we look out for if we come across a lizard?
The main things to look out for, I mean, with the lizards that you find around the New South Wales area, you're looking at mainly small skinks or dragons. The only lizard which I would consider to be a danger to a human at all would be a large goanna, something like a lace monitor, or in western New South Wales, things like sand goannas. These are animals which can grow up to around 6 feet long and weigh in excess of 8 to 10 kilos, and they have the defence of using their tail as a whip. They have razor-sharp claws for scaling up trees extremely quickly, and they have razor-sharp teeth. Now, they're not known to attack people, but they are attracted to campsites by the smell of food. So if you're cooking things like sausages, steaks, even eggs, they can pick up on the scent of egg very well. They will come in and try and scavenge for that food. If that's the case, the best thing to do is to leave them alone. Don't attempt to get too close to them, because they can actually turn around and give either a nasty bite if you try and hold them, or whip you with their tail if you get too close.
Okay, now, probably one thing we should point out is that it's actually illegal to kill snakes in Australia, is that right?
It is absolutely illegal to kill any reptile or amphibian in Australia. The only amphibian that they allow people to kill is the cane toad up in Queensland and the Northern Territory. The reason for this is before these reptiles were protected, they were killed just in excess. Any person that saw a snake, whether it be a potentially harmless snake like a python or an extremely dangerous snake, they would just kill them outright. So we've had them protected because, as we all know, every native animal has a reason to be in the ecosystem, and snakes are no different.
Well, on behalf of everyone listening, thanks very much for your time, Stuart.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's time to delve into the GeoTalk mailbag.
Hello, Spindoc Bob. I'm Sir Z-Man, host of another geocaching podcast out of the Twin Cities in Minnesota in the United States of America. I'm sending you this feedback to say congratulations on a great first show. I enjoyed listening to it, and I'm looking forward to hearing many more. If you or any of your audience are interested in hearing what caching is like in Minnesota, please feel free to check out my podcast at TCGC PC, like Twin Cities Geocaching Podcast.com. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for that, Sir Z-Man. We also got an email from Alex over in South Australia, who goes by the name of Team Canyonero. You might remember that from the Simpsons cartoons. You might also remember, if you go geocaching in Canberra, that he's the owner of one of the most difficult caches in the ACT, and I mentioned it in the last episode, and that was Can You Hear the Bells, Fernando? Now, he writes that one of the funniest things that ever occurred was at a geocaching event called Clear Caching Capers back in 2002. And during the event, he decided that he was going to hide a geocache and then put it up on geocaching.com a few days later. But while he was at the event, someone from a Team GeoCoopers, Jeremy, actually found the cache because he was planning on placing a cache in exactly the same spot. So he's probably one of the first to find geocaches. Thanks very much for your email, Alex. I also got an email from St. Louis, Missouri, from Paul Konopaki. I hope I pronounced that correctly. He's got a podcast in the St. Louis area, so if you're ever heading out in that way or want to know a bit about geocaching in that area, I'll put a link on the show notes for you to check that out. And finally, an email from Team Wombat over in Western Australia, who's very excited because just this weekend gone, WA has entered daylight savings, and that's the first time in many a year. And it's part of a trial, so everyone who is geocaching WA, make the most of the extra hour of daylight in the afternoon or evening. And finally, in the mailbag, we got an email from Mix, who we heard back in episode 1. He set up a website called GCA Media, where he's included a number of YouTube videos of himself trekking around New South Wales and looking for geocaches and fixing them up. So check that out. Here's a little sneak peek from one of those videos.
So we'll just start looking around here for a place that might have a cache. Okay, I found a spot which sort of matches the clue. I'm a bit worried about it, though, because the last time I was here, it looked like it was home to the biggest red-bellied black snake I've ever seen. But I'm going to bravely dive in and hope for the best. I found it.
Well, that brings us to the end of episode 3 of GeoTalk. Thanks once again for joining us. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with episode 4, a special Christmas edition of GeoTalk. Don't forget, you can send us an email at geotalk@mac.com. You can also find us on the web at geotalk.libsyn.com, or you can register through iTunes. Until next time, safe geocaching.